Hi there. Just a quick note that if you're hearing this, it means you haven't yet upgraded to the Misfit feed. I encourage you to become a Misfit right now and immediately unlock every single full-length episode that I've ever done, and you can immediately start learning from some of the greatest entrepreneurs in history. It is absolutely insane how much you can learn for such a small investment, but don't take my word for it. Let me just read a couple of the testimonials from Misfits. It says, I just paid for my first premium podcast subscription for Founders Podcast. Learning from those who came before us is one of the highest value ways to invest time. David does his homework and exponentially improves my efficiency by focusing on the most valuable lessons. Another person said, I stumbled upon this podcast. After one episode, I quickly joined the Misfit feed since $5 a month is the equivalent of a few cups of coffee for great detailed biographies on amazing leaders. I love the insights and thoughts shared along the way. David loves what he does and it shines through on the podcast. Definitely my go-to podcast now. And just one more before I get into today's preview. It is worth every penny. I cannot put into words how fantastic this podcast is. Just stop reading this and get the full access now. I agree with every single one of them, obviously. I hope you do as well. If you do, tap the link that's in the show notes on your podcast player or go to founderspodcast.com. It takes less than a minute to set up and you can start learning from some of the greatest minds in history. Rockefeller was a unique hybrid in American business. Both the instinctive first-generation entrepreneur who founds the company and the analytical second-generation manager who extends and develops it. He wasn't the sort of rugged, self-made mogul who quickly becomes irrelevant to his own organization. For that reason, his career anticipates the managerial capitalism of the 20th century. Since he never owned more than a third of his company, he needed the cooperation of other people. Having created an empire of unfathomable complexity, he was smart enough to see that he had to submerge his identity in the organization. Many people noted that Rockefeller seldom said, I. This is a direct quote from him. Don't say that I ought to do this or that, he preached to colleagues. We ought to do it. Never forget that we are partners. Whatever is done for the general good is done for the good of us all. He preferred outspoken colleagues to weak-kneed sycophants and welcomed differences of opinion so long as they weren't personalized. By creating new industrial forms, Rockefeller left his stamp on an age that lauded inventors, not administrators. That he created one of the first multinational corporations, selling kerosene around the world and setting a business pattern for the next century, was arguably his greatest feat. Okay, so that was from the book that I want to talk to you about today. It's called Titan, The Life of John D. Rockefeller by Ron Chernow. And those three paragraphs just appeared about 220 pages into the 700-page biography. And there's a few times where I couldn't figure out how I wanted to start this podcast or where what I wanted to talk about, because the book delves into like his early life, goes into great detail how he got his start in business and then how he created Standard Oil, which is what he's most well known for. But I think that those few paragraphs give you an idea of why that's so important, because there's been plenty of businesses built throughout time that were wildly successful, similar to Standard Oil. But he was the first, really credited with the first person that created what is very common today, which is a multinational corporation, except he was doing this in the 1800s. What I want to focus on for the purpose of this podcast is the strategy that he used in business, which I found most fascinating. So I want to talk to you about something called the Cleveland Massacre, which before I read this book, I knew nothing about. But before we get there, I want to give you an intro to the Cleveland Massacre that gives you an idea of the mind he had with business. And this is just a short two paragraphs. So let me go ahead and read that to you. The spot chosen for the new refinery tells much in miniature about Rockefeller's approach to business. He exercised an option on a 3-acre parcel on the sloping red clay banks of a narrow waterway called Kingsbury Run, which flowed into the Chuahoga River and thus provided passage to Lake Erie. A mile and a half from downtown Cleveland, it seemed at first glance an inauspicious site for the new refinery. In these outskirts beyond the city limits, cows browsed peacefully and trees still shaded the waterway. But for Rockefeller, the inconvenience was outweighed by the fact they would soon adjoin new railroad tracks. On November 3, 1863, proudly flying the Union colors, remember this is around the time of the Civil War, a gleaming locomotive of the Atlantic and Great Western Railroad pulled into a Cleveland station decked with bunting and launched a new era, giving the town access to New York City via the Erie Railroad and to a valuable direct route to the Pennsylvania oil fields. Before I read you the last sentence, remember at this time, almost all of the world's oil, besides some large Russian oil fields, came from Pennsylvania. So that's why the Pennsylvania oil fields are so important. And this is the last sentence here. Able to ship by water or over land, Rockefeller gained the critical leverage he needed to secure preferential rates on transportation, which was why he agonized over plant locations throughout his career. So they're saying he did this because he needed the leverage to secure preferential rates on transportation. Now, why is that important? Well, this has to do with probably the single best idea he ever had in business. And again, it depends on which whose perspective you're looking at it from, because his competitors certainly didn't think it was a great idea. But for him, it was undoubtedly a great idea. So this is going to lead me to what's known as the Cleveland Massacre. And the Cleveland Massacre is going to be, I would say, the bulk of this podcast, and I think is the most important idea to understand how Rockefeller became the richest person maybe in the history of the world. Now, there's obviously some ambiguity over this, because you have to account for like the difference between purchasing price and what is actually valued. But the estimates that I've read and seen say Rockefeller in today's money would be worth somewhere between $300 and $400 billion, or to look at it another way, 3 to 4 times as rich as the richest person is today. So let me jump into the Cleveland Massacre. It's really interesting. By the late 1860s, this dynamic produced a persuasive slump in the oil industry, keeping it depressed for the next 5 years. So to give you some context right there, Rockefeller's already owned some refineries in Cleveland. And just like today, there's booms and busts in the oil market, there was back then. So we're in a persuasive slump in this time period. Low kerosene prices. Now remember, again, this is before the invention of the car. So kerosene was the main byproduct of oil. People used it, and before people used it to basically have lighting in their house. But before Rockefeller, only really rich people were able to do this. After Rockefeller, everybody could do it. Low kerosene prices, a boon to consumers, were catastrophic for refiners, who saw the profit margin between crude and refined oil prices shrink to a vanishing point. Rampant speculation had so overbuilt the industry that total refining capacity in 1870 was triple the amount of crude oil being pumped. Okay, so there's a lot of people making money in refinery. People hear other people about other people making money in refineries. So what do? Naturally, they follow in like lemmings, and this causes the refining capacity to be triple the amount that they actually need, which then kind of screws everybody else over. By then, Rockefeller estimated 90% of all refineries were operating in the red. At this bleak impasse, a leading Cleveland rival, John Alexander, offered to sell his interest to William Rockefeller at 10 cents on the dollar, as the entire industry faced ruin. William Rockefeller is John's younger brother and his business partner. One of his business partners. Worse, the oil market wasn't correcting itself according to the self-regulating mechanism dear to neoclassical economists. Producers and refiners didn't shut down operations in the expected numbers, causing Rockefeller to doubt the workings of Adam Smith's theoretical invisible hand. So many wells were flowing, this is a direct quote from him now, so many wells were flowing that the price of oil kept falling, yet they went right on drilling, end quote. The industry was trapped in a full-blown crisis of overproduction with no relief in sight. So that part actually reminded me about another quote that appears later in the book. So I'm going to jump ahead just to this quote from Rockefeller and then back to the Cleveland Massacre. As Rockefeller noted, this is a direct quote from him, oftentimes the most difficult competition comes not from the strong, the intelligent, the conservative competitor, but from the man who is holding on by the eyelids and is ignorant of his cost, and anyway, he's got to keep running or bust. So to me, that is a great explanation of what's happening around the time right before the Cleveland Massacre, where he's saying, it's not the intelligent people I can reason with. It's the person who doesn't even know his cost, doesn't even realize that every barrel of oil that he's refining, he's losing money on, but keeps going anyways because he has to do something. All right, so let's go back to the setup of the Cleveland Massacre. Thus, in 1869, 1 year after his stellar railroad coup, which we'll get to in a minute, Rockefeller feared that his wealth might be snatched away from him. As someone who tended toward optimism, seeing opportunity in every disaster, he studied the situation exhaustively instead of bemoaning his bad luck. He saw that his individual success as a refiner was now menaced by industry-wide failure, and that it therefore demanded a systemic solution. This was a momentous insight, pregnant with consequences. Instead of just tending to his own business, he began to conceive of the industry as a gigantic, interrelated mechanism, and thought in terms of strategic alliances and long-term planning. Rockefeller cited the years 1869 and 1870 as the start of his campaign to replace competition with cooperation in the industry, what is also known as monopoly. The culprit, he decided, was, quote, the overdevelopment of the refining industry, end quote, which had created ruinous competition. If this fractious industry was to be made profitable and enduring, he would have to tame and discipline it. A trailblazer who improvised solutions without any guidance from economic text, he began to envision a giant cartel that would reduce overcapacity, stabilize prices, and rationalize the industry. That description right there kind of sounds like what OPEC tries to do today, except this Rockefeller had this idea, 1869. If Rockefeller first expounded this idea among refiners, he was anticipated by the very drillers who later railed at his machinations. During the Civil War, they had formed an Oil Creek Association to curtail production and lift prices, and on February 1, 1869, they again met in Oil City to create the Petroleum Producers Association to protect their interests. Again, I would say these are precursors to what OPEC does. What's interesting about this part is what Rockefeller is most hated for is the creation of a cartel. But I would say he's only hated because he's the one that actually succeeded at it. As we're going to see, there's many people that are trying to do very similar things. And interesting enough, they would criticize Rockefeller for what they were doing themselves. So let's go back to the book. To devise a comprehensive solution for the industry, Rockefeller again needed money. Money to create economies of scale, money to build cash reserves to endure downturns, money to heighten efficiency. And here's another direct quote from him. And to buy in the many refineries that were a source of overproduction and confusion, we needed a great deal of money, end quote. The tricky part for Rockefeller and Flagler, this is, Flagler is Henry Flagler, which is one of the founders, co-founders of Standard Oil. He's famous in his own right. He developed, I would say, much of Florida. So his name's like all over St. Augustine. He developed Miami, Miami Beach. So there's all, you'll see his name constantly. And he's actually a really, like a flamboyant, interesting historical figure. I'm going to go back and see if I can find any biographies on him because I learned a little bit about him in this book, and he was way more flamboyant and way more interesting as an individual than I think Rockefeller was. Rockefeller is interesting because of his business strategy. Flagler was just he was just insane. So let me go back to this. The tricky part for Rockefeller and Flagler was how to supplement their capital without relinquishing control. The solution was to incorporate, which would enable them to sell shares to select outside investors. I wish I had the brains to think of it, said Rockefeller. It was Henry Flagler, meaning Flagler's idea. Luckily, and here's the weird part, when this next section, this is going to seem very bizarre to us today because starting a company is relatively easy. Yeah, you can be, you have one-person companies that are, with the help of the internet, that are multinational corporations per se. So that never existed in the 1860s. In fact, you'll see that some states, like you could have a company in one state and you're literally, it's illegal to do business in another state, which Rockefeller had to devise trusts and a network of, complex network of companies to get around because he sold kerosene all over the world. Okay, so here, let's go back to this. Lucky many states had now passed laws permitting companies to incorporate. The one hitch, and it was a formidable one for Rockefeller, was that these firms couldn't own property outside their state of incorporation. To finesse this restriction would require endless legal legerdemain. I'm not sure what that word means. On January 10th, 1870, the partnership of Rockefeller, Andrews, and Flagler was abolished and replaced by a joint stock firm called the Standard Oil Company, with John D. Rockefeller as president, William Rockefeller as vice president, Flagler as secretary and treasurer. Besides echoing their Standard Works refinery, the name advertised the uniform quality of their kerosene at a time when consumers feared explosions from impurities. With $1 million in capital, that's $11 million in contemporary money, the new company became an instant landmark in business history, for there was no other concern in the country organized with such capital, Rockefeller said. I want to take a break real quick here to let you know. He's also doing this. He's in his 20s. So he started refining oil when he was about 24, if I'm not mistaken. So he's really young, and we'll see at the end of this what's about to take place. He's still really young when this happens. You'll see in a minute. Already a mini-empire, Standard Oil controlled 10% of American petroleum refining, as well as a barrel-making plant, warehouses, shipping facilities, and a fleet of tank cars. Tank cars is what was used to transport oil if you didn't want to put it in a barrel. From the outset, Rockefeller's plans had a wide streak of megalomania. As he told Cleveland businessman John Prindle, quote, "The Standard Oil Company will someday refine all the oil and make all the barrels," end quote. He gets very close to that, actually. Despite his lack of legal training, Flagler drew up the Act of Incorporation. Nearly 60 years later, when the document was dredged up in a legal dispute, people were stunned by its simplicity. Instead of a fancy embossed paper dripping with seals, one reporter described it as a cheap-looking legal paper, faded yellow, and of evident poor material, granting the Standard Oil Company the right to engage in business. This economical, no-nonsense approach appealed to investors, as did Rockefeller's decision that the leading men would receive no salary, but would profit solely from the appreciation of their shares and rising dividends, which Rockefeller thought a more potent stimulus to work. So he wanted everybody aligned, their incentives all aligned. And we see this one decision where he said no one's going to get salary, and you're going to profit solely from dividends and shares. This is what makes him the richest man in the world. So thanks for making it to the end of this preview. If you want to listen to the full episode, this is Founders number 16. So after you upgrade, you'll get access to the private feed. You can listen to the private feed just like any other in your favorite podcast player, just like any other podcast. And the difference between the preview feed and the Misfit feed is the Misfit feed has every single full episode, but they're also numbered, so you're able to find them easily. This is Founders number 16. So if you upgrade, you can go right to 16 and listen to the full episode. I also read John D. Rockefeller's autobiography, and that is Founders number 148, if you want to listen to that one as well. If you upgrade, you get access to every single full episode. There's over 170 full-length episodes that you can unlock right now. It's a really good value at only $5 a month or $49 a year. The annual plan is extremely popular because it works out to less than a dollar a week to listen to some of the greatest minds, entrepreneurial minds in history. I was reading through and looking through lists of biographies. I find new biographies to read all the time. Right now, I'm adding at least one a week to the Misfit feed. And recently, I found this great list of biographies, of recommended biographies from the writer Ryan Holiday. And he said something in this list, at the beginning of his list, saying, you know, why he felt it was so important to read biographies. So I'm going to read this to you because I also think it illustrates the value that you get by upgrading and becoming a subscriber to Founders. And he says, "Smart people read biographies. Generalizations are usually worthless, but you can pretty much take this one to the bank. Look at their libraries and you'll see one biography and memoir and autobiography after another. Of course, they read other things. It's called being well-rounded, but biographies are usually the core. There's a reason. It's some of the most actionable and educational reading you can do. Think about it. A biography is a sweeping portrait of a life or a career. It covers vast swaths of material that the author must make immediately understood within the context of an individual and their life." And so I bring that to your attention because, one, I think Ryan Holiday is a gifted writer, and he's able to explain the value of biographies in just a few sentences there. But two, it's also something I've discovered as I continue to read hundreds of these biographies. You realize that the people that we're studying on founders and the people that we're learning from also did this very activity. They talk about it constantly, the importance of reading biographies. Some of them have read hundreds of biographies in their life. And so when I look at something like that, I step back and ask myself, it's like, okay, why are some of the smartest, most productive, and this is, let me back up actually before I get there. This is why I've come to believe that learning from biographies is a mandatory activity if you want to live a good life. So let me step back. I look at this, I'm like, okay, why are some of the smartest, most productive people that have ever lived all engaging in this activity? They didn't know each other. In many cases, they lived in different parts of the globe. They lived different times in history. And yet they all arrived at the same conclusion. And so then I ask myself again, are these silly people? Are these people prone to waste time? And the answer is, of course not. And so that leads me to the value proposition for founders, right? Like, why would you want to invest your hard-earned money in doing this? And my answer to that is, yes, there's a lot of information. You're going to learn a lot of great ideas. You're going to learn also a lot of ideas to avoid, and you're going to be inspired by their life stories about how they overcome obstacles. Everybody in their lives runs into obstacles, and the people that we read about and that we study on this podcast fight their way through it, right? And you can draw inspiration from their refusal to quit and apply it to your life. But the main value is time. Very few people have enough. How many biographies, how many books in general do you have time to read on a monthly, yearly basis? For a vast majority of people, they're not going to read a couple hundred biographies in their life. But that doesn't mean you have to miss out on knowing the most important ideas that are contained therein. And that's what Founders does. The most common way subscribers get value out of Founders is they say, okay, I'm going to listen to, maybe I'll listen to a dozen, a couple dozen, maybe 50, maybe 100 of these episodes. And by doing so, I'll learn the key insights from remarkable lives. And then out of the podcast I listen to, I'll either read or get the Audible version of maybe 10 or 20 books a year. And I'll do that year in and year out. And then over time, the value of the ideas you learn and the inspiration you draw from these life stories compound. And I think that's exactly what we see with some of the greatest minds in history. They did this exact same thing. They didn't just read biographies for a year. They did it when they were young. They did it when they were older. And they did it when they were elderly. They never stopped learning. And that's what Founders does. It takes some of the most actionable and educational reading you can do, which is biographies, and it speeds up that process. So don't wait. The sooner you learn these ideas, the sooner you can apply them to your life. All you have to do to access them is upgrade by tapping the link that's in your show notes in your podcast player or going to founderspodcast.com. And I hope to see you on the Misfit feed.